Let's talk. John Brown. I'm really been looking forward to this because it's called 1975, the year the world forgot. If you think that music in the median year of the 70s was all sort of Jethro Tull, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, the Yes, Genesis, bestriding the earth like some sort of demons, well, before the heady days of punk came crashing through the front door. Well, you're wrong, because Dylan Jones, who knows a thing or two about this, has absolutely written a brilliant book about how it was the apogee of adult rock. I'm delighted to say that he joins me live on the line, probably from a recording studio or sipping a martini somewhere over, you know, the Laurel Canyon. Dylan, lovely to have you back on. Last time we talked was about your Elvis book, of course, and that was, well, I mean, you always think it's about 2 years ago, and then it turns out to be about something like seven or something.
It's a long time ago, but it's very nice to see you again, and thank you for having me on.
Pleasure's mine, because it's easy to sneer at like 1975 and go, well, you see, it was the hippies had run out of steam. They were all in the studios. They were all, there wasn't, you know, the youth music was coming on. And it wasn't like that sort of, and there were massive prog rock things, you know, 18 year guitar solos. In fact, you argue very, very well indeed that there was serious grown-up writing going on, and for some bands, they were producing their meisterworks. Fleetwood Mac, of course, this year pull out for the untitled album, and then it becomes Rumours next year. But, you know, bands like Queen, for example. So in your own words, Dylan, what was the spark behind this one?
Well, I've always been a huge fan of the books about particular years. I enjoyed John Savage's book about 1966. I enjoyed David Hepworth's book about 1971. And there have been lots of other books about particular post-war years that I've enjoyed. And not to denigrate David or John's books at all, but 66 and 71 are far more obvious choices. And the reason that I wanted to celebrate 1975, because I think it gets forgotten about. I mean, when punk happened, I was as enthusiastic as anyone else. And I went to all those gigs and I saw most of those artists, and I loved it. And it was a much needed correction in the culture. However, when I made my way back to my halls of residence in Albert Bridge Road in the summer of 1977, I would play those records that I was told I wasn't allowed to like anymore. Because, as you know, there was an incredible year zero attitude towards punk. And so for a while, the only records from the past that you were allowed to play were by Iggy Pop or the MC5 and the New York Dolls and people like that. And of course, I loved those records because I'd been a keen consumer of the NME and I knew who these people were. But also, I was young. I was, you know, 15, 16, 17, still very curious about music and still consuming a lot of music that I felt was extraordinary. And by the likes of Bob Dylan and Patti Smith and Roxy Music and David Bowie, and Neil Young, Bruce Springsteen, et cetera, et cetera. So I wasn't about to abandon them. And there was a lot of cases of people throwing record collections away and taking their record collections down to Cheapo in Soho as though the past had never happened. But I was susceptible as anyone else, but I always thought that was a little silly. So I kept my record collection.
Well, exactly. Well done you. You don't have. I like the idea of a year zero, because it was. I mean, at the time, I mean, Led Zeppelin. I mean, Robert Plant wasn't that much older than the brave new punks that were coming in. So to say, oh, they're dinosaurs, they're the past. I mean, music taste doesn't change. You know, one morning you wake up, there's a new dawn, and everybody's putting safety pins in various parts of their body. Is it? I mean, there's a progression, which obviously.
Well, I think culturally sometimes things do happen like that, and like I say, I think it was a much needed correction. But I remember this is illustrated by Rusty Egan, who was one of the architects of the Blitz nightclub and one of the foremost creators of the New Romantic movement. He auditioned to be a drummer in The Clash. And they went for all these auditions. And he said he he got on with them really well. Musically, he fitted fantastically well, but he said he just couldn't get over the fact that they'd go for a cup of tea and the ideology would come out and said, right, we don't like Bob Dylan, we don't like the Stones, we don't like the Beatles. And Rusty would go, well, no, I do like the Stones, actually. And so there was this inability to accept anything from the past. And you know what? And I get that. And it probably needed to be that way. But because it needed to be that way, and because that previous couple of years were kind of swept away, like I say, I think a lot of amazing music has been forgotten about during a period where people from the 60s were a little bit older, as you say, you know, they were in their 30s. I mean, so young now. We thought they were ancient at the time, but they were very, very young. But they did produce some amazing music.
Luckily, because we're both in our mid-40s, Dylan, we can look back at that.
Well done.
But the other thing is, of course, that if you look at what people were listening on, hi-fi, FM. I mean, in the States, you've got FM coming on, and that one might argue that this 75, everything carries on as normal in the States because they get OR and orientated rock, and you know, REO Speedwagon, all that lot come. So if you've got a woofer and tweeter and whatever, then the latest Pink Floyd album is going to be something you can really enjoy. Perhaps something more than the UK subs can offer.
God, I saw the UK sub far off than I needed to. I think once was probably too much, actually. But I mean, I think that's also right, because this was a period in the early to mid 70s, when musicians weren't afraid to call themselves artists. Mm. And yes, there was a lot of pomposity and there was a lot of dreadful music made. But as you say, it wasn't all prog rock concept albums or Southern boogie bands. And one of the things that I tried to display in this book is the enormous variety, because you had incredible things happening in soul. You had amazing things happening in disco, in electro. You had Noi, you had Kraftwerk. You had Keith Jarrett making an amazing jazz album that turned out to be one of the best-selling jazz albums ever, very unlikely. And you had Smokey Robinson, Millie Jackson, such a wide variety of music. And also, I think at the time, in the music press, I wouldn't call it racist, but there was certainly, I think, a lot of black music, a lot of dance music wasn't afforded the same kind of respect that rock music was. And obviously there has been a massive correction recently, much needed. And so I think it's fair to cover the waterfront and show that in 1975, as well as the likes of Patti Smith, Bob Dylan, Neil Young, Roxy Music, David Bowie, there was an awful lot of really interesting dance music happening as well.
And of course, you can say that dance music, like, I mean, it's the stuff that James Brown is at this point, 75, he's been doing this for basically 20 years, but he's putting political message in, as is Gil Scott-Heron, you know, and they're putting it on a dance floor, or they're putting it as music that is technically brilliant, but has a message. So you can like the music if you're like, oh, that's a rather pleasant tune, but my goodness, the message beneath it is absolutely spot on.
Yeah, I think that you're right. If you take the music that Marvin Gaye was making in the early 70s, and then the music that Curtis Mayfield was making, and I talk about one of his records in this book, is that it was social commentary, and often their social commentary was far more strident and far more particular and far more exact and far more cutting than things that you would find elsewhere. Because I think that there was still an element of idealism in rock music. I think there was a lot of narcissism, and that was sort of diametrically opposite to some of the things that Curtis Mayfield and Marvin Gaye were doing. And that narcissism produced a lot of rubbish, as we know. But also, you take something like Blood on the Tracks, which is probably the first major work of art by a musician who emerged in the 60s. And it's basically, it's about divorce. It's like a John Updike novel. Mm. And he was discussing emotions and complexities in a relationship that people like me who were, barely kissed a girl in a disco, it was complete anathema. And so it was fascinating because I think also at that period when you're a teenager, there's a big, big element of wanting to be older than you are, and you're consuming culture and material and ideas and books and records and films, which explain a world that you haven't experienced yet, which is why when you're 13 and 14, you were so desperate to get into an 18 movie. It wasn't just because of the sex. It was often about the sex, but it was about experiencing things which we were too young to experience.
And of course, the other thing is, and I always say, nothing exists in a vacuum. This is the young generation who've grown up the ideas of the 60s, the hippie thing or whatever, or that cheeky, chappy, pop group thing. And now they've gone through the 60s into the 70s. You've had the oil crisis. You've had Vietnam. You may have kids. This is a generation that is growing up in public in a way that the generation perhaps of the 50s didn't do. And therefore they are writing about that. And you're looking at the films of, coming out Dog Day of the Afternoon, De Pacino stuff, Scorsese stuff. And it's, De Niro coming on. It's the very public, what am I doing here? Why am I here? These albums and these songs reflect that.
Yeah, and I think that you said earlier that in many respects that culture wasn't as affected in North America because it that kind of West Coast ideology was very particular. However, a lot of American culture in the early to mid 70s again is demonized, but it shouldn't be, because you look at the extraordinary works produced by novelists and saliently the work produced by American film directors in that time. And they were the ones who were pushing the culture. Mm. We may have been pushing culture in a slightly different way in the UK, principally driven by music and fashion in a kind of guttersnipe way. But in America, the film directors at that time were moving the culture on leaps and bounds. Every 5 minutes, there was another massive milestone, whether it was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest or Deer Hunter or Apocalypse Now or Taxi Driver or what have you.
Also, you have, if you like, looking at people like Eno, who's, looking at people like, that'll be a critic trying to get in, obviously.
Sorry.
I can hear that, yes.
I need to calm my dog down. I'm very sorry.
You mentioned the deer hunter, obviously set him off. Off you go. It's all right, Dylan. You go and calm down the dog and I shall keep talking. One of the great things about live radio, ladies and gentlemen, is the fact that your pooch can get involved and disrupt the interview. But I'm sure that Dylan will be calming the savage beast, perhaps by putting on some Bob Dylan and Blood on the Tracks. 952-784-4000 is the phone number, by the way. I'm with you until 12 o'clock. looking forward to having Dylan Jones rejoining us, for goodness sake.
See? Only have I come back, exactly. But I've also brought a small white furry animal who can contribute to the conversation, who is a big fan of music made in 1975.
I can tell he's almost got this looking. And for those who don't know, this is not a Rottweiler, despite the noise he just made. This is a very cute white. And the name of the pooch,
he's called Louis, and he's a multi-poo.
Louis the multi-poo. Yeah,
he's very aggressive.
Yeah, I can hear that. He was looking at me. He was looking at me through the Zoom.
Sit down there, boy.
But if you, I'm keep my voice maybe a little bit quieter just in case I set him off again. If you look at the Great Oz, though, if you look at, because Roxy Music has been doing very interesting things. Eno is about to go absolutely the way we can do. And meanwhile, behind shuttered blinds somewhere in the Los Angeles, Bowie's having another transformation that will see him come out of this. But in the meantime, he manages to bang out, first white boy on Soul Train, etc. So it is, even the dinosaurs are cutting their own paths.
Well, I think if you take Bowie, when he was making the transition from rock music to something that was far more kind of dance driven through young Americans. And I think he acknowledges that he made a mistake by calling it a Plastic Soul album. Because it's an extraordinarily accomplished soul album and possibly his best record of the 70s. And that record has really endured. I think that it's got better. And I think if you listen to that record now in isolation, not having heard it before, it's an amazing piece of work. But again, Roxy Music doing the same thing. Siren was an album that really acknowledged the dance floor, which Brian Ferry hadn't done before. And I think as soon as you get particularly men of a certain age discussing Roxy Music, they will tend to have an argument about which was the best album, the first one or the second one. Personally, I think it's between the third and the fourth. It's between Country Life and Stranded, with Siren coming up a very, very quick number two, because Siren, again, is a magisterial piece of work. And it's one of those records that has forgotten about, because I think by 1975, lots of people thought that Roxy's firepower had faded somewhat.
Yeah, but it's, I mean, again, if for people who sort of think that it's all, they were sort of just glam, I mean, Roxy are far more complicated than that. Can we just talk about the band who 75, Queen, Night of the Opera, and then Queen, it's a huge album, and it's, but then again, it's not until perhaps 85 and that performance at Live Aid that they become fashionable again. But if you listen to, again, if you had landed on the earth and didn't know anything about Queen and listened to The Night at the Opera, you just go, good grief.
Yes and no.
Okay.
Queen are significant by their absence from this book because, as you say, they were always a blind spot for me. I just didn't get Queen. And I didn't get Queen and until I went to Live Aid and I saw them perform. And that was an amazing experience because in 20 minutes they managed to condense their entire career into something that appealed to a snotty style journalist like myself. And like a lot of other people, went out and reacquainted myself with their records. They were amazingly successful in the mid-70s, and I think it's completely legitimate for you to mention them because there'll be lots of people who were 15 at the time and lots of people who are 15 now who are interested in that music. So I suppose even though subjectively I didn't particularly like them, they are yet another example of how great and diverse music was in that year.
Also, it's not just a hairy-chested male situation here. You've got Joni Mitchell and the path of female artists as well. Through that whole thing as well during the 70s, where am I going? What am I doing? A legendary singer-songwriter. Hissing of Summer Lawns is one of your...
Yeah, the Hissing of Summer Lawns, which is almost certainly the high point of her work. And Joni Mitchell was probably the most navel-gazing singer-songwriter that there was. But she had the quality and the sophistication and the ability to make work that was incredibly engrossing and didn't appear to be so self-indulgent because she was such a great writer. And then on the other hand, you take someone like Patti Smith, who was generally transgressive. And there's a book out at the moment by a New York restaurateur called Keith McNally. And he was called by New York magazine once the man who invented downtown. And actually, I think that you could say Patti Smith invented downtown because in 1975, women didn't look like that.
Yeah.
And she was part of the kind of CBGB crowd, the kind of nascent early punk fraternity of Richard Hell and the Voidoids and Television and Blondie and the Ramones, which was a couple of years before the UK. But if you look at the cover of Horses and that amazing photograph by Robert Mapplethorpe, women didn't look like that in 1975. And that was a very aggressive, transgressive, transformative image, black and white, harsh, quite male. And yes, the music was different, but I think the imagery was even more different because she was selling something that hadn't been sold before in that way.
She's also an artist. I mean, it's like, I'm going to put this album out. I can't be bothered, you know, publish and be damned, basically, because I am creating something that I believe in 100%. I'm not going to do Sugar Baby Love. I'm going to put this album out called Horses. And if you come to that album now, having not heard it before, you'll just go, ye gods, where did this come from? And you can see the line that goes, continues all the way through the punk and the new wave thing through Debbie Harry, who's obviously is a major influence as well, but every sort of punk chantess or whatever from then, or any new generation singer songwriter.
No, I think you're completely right, and they did things in a way that wasn't really understandable at the time, because again, a lot of the media was controlled by men, and women were mediated in a very, very different way. And I think that you talk about artists. That's another thing. After punk, aspiring to be an artist was deemed to be pretentious, unnecessary, old-fashioned. You were called that. You were a victim of overreach. But actually, these artists, like I said earlier on, these musicians had no qualms about being called artists. They wanted to be called artists, and they had the ability to deliver that. Whereas a lot of people didn't. They were just self-indulgent. But they had the quality and the sophistication and the chops to make it work.
And then especially, it doesn't mean you have to have a treble album, you know, with a dragon on the inside of it. I mean, being an artist is putting work out. I mean, look at Bjork, for example, has been, you know, there or thereabouts for the best part of 30 years now. And it's the same thing. You just create. How difficult is it for you to actually condense all this? And obviously Stevie Nicks on the front cover. I mean, this is 50 years ago. I mean, how difficult is it for you? Because music means so much to so many different people. It is a time machine. It will transport you to Albert Bridge Road or Battersea Bridge Road or wherever you are. It will let you know what you're eating, what you were feeling, who you were seeing, what you were smelling like. How different is it for you, Dylan, to be dispassionate? Because obviously you've been writing very well for a while now.
Well, I think that it has to start with an idea, and the idea it tends to be a subjective idea because it's an opinion. But it was very important for me not to make the book, you know, music I like.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of boring. And you can sell it and you can do it in a particular way, but it becomes very narrow and quite narcissistic. And I wanted to prove my point. But it has to be objective, because I write a lot about two artists that I didn't really have much time for in 1975, which was Fleetwood Mac and Led Zeppelin. And I didn't get Led Zeppelin. Led Zeppelin, for me, were the reason for punk.
Yeah.
Because I thought it was self-indulgent, this one, that one. And actually, I was wrong. And it wasn't until I was older that I really understood the sophistication of Led Zeppelin. And Fleetwood Mac, again, I thought were too, they were too West Coast. They looked like they'd had all the edges taken off them. But actually now I appreciate that music for what it was, which was some of the best pop music ever made. Certainly some of the best radio friendly pop music ever made. I think drugs were very important too. Not that I want to be classified.
I know I'm sitting in Marbella, Dylan, and it's almost 12 o'clock, but please,
I don't want to be an advocate for cocaine, but I think if you look at
surely not Fleetwood Mac in the mid-70s, Dylan, please, please, my beefy
heart. Listen to that music. That music was made on a lot of cocaine, and they're good records.
Yeah, indeed. But also, I mean, Fleetwood Mac is because they have the background of Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac, and then they have Buckingham Nicks come in, and it completely changes it. And we have that genre of music that isn't Skinnerd, and it's not sort of, you know, the Allman Brothers. It's they both bring something really unique.
Pop music.
Yeah.
And it isn't, you're right. And I think the reason that music has clicked with a different generation now,
yeah,
is because it is pop music. And when my daughters listen to Dreams,
yeah,
or they listen to something from Rumours, for them it could have been made yesterday, because it isn't self-indulgent, it isn't long, it isn't prog, it isn't boogie, it's not redolent of the early 70s. That music is now owned by everyone.
My goddaughter went to see Stevie Nicks play in Hyde Park, which probably your little one probably went to see that as well.
I was at that gig. I took my daughters. They loved it.
And how many young sort of independent theme, an awful lot of witchy wardrobe stuff going on, but still just proves it's resonant.
I think that is so true. And I think it's really interesting when you go and see so-called legacy bands looking at the audience, because you can go and see some, and everyone looks like me. They're a bald guy in their 50s or 60s. And then you go and see other artists like yourself.
Thank you.
You go and see other artists, and you're right. And they're full of kids. They're full of teenagers and people in their 20s and 30s and 40s. And Fleetwood Mac and Stevie Nicks certainly have that appeal.
The book, I could talk to you this until obviously the fearsome hound comes back and rips my arm off and hits me with the soggy end. The book is called 1975, The Year the World Forgot. It is by the excellent Dylan Jones. Listeners, you can order it via our own virtual bookstore. Just go to tre.radio. You will see the front cover. It's got Stevie Nicks on it. Click on it and it'll be winging its way to you. Dylan, if people want to follow you on the socials and say nice things to you, where is the best place to say hello to you? Or do you have a website? Where can people follow you?
I'm on Instagram. It's Dylan Jones. It's very simple. So yeah, please get in touch and be nice.
Indeed. And apart from how to deal with the savage hound, what's your next book probably going to be, do you think?
I'm actually a third of the way into my next book, which is another oral biography, and I'm doing restaurant culture in London over the last 50 years.
Got to go now. News up next. Dylan, thank you so much for your time today.
Online. Thank you.